take me to your ladder.
Let me call our guest and see if he picks up here.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, Greg. How are you?
All right. I have no way to route anything that we're talking about. I have no way to route Skype away from the actual broadcast. So everybody's hearing what we're saying right now. Play the opening. What, you got notes? I hear notes there.
Oh yeah, I got some. Well, just I had some passages from some books just in case I needed to remember something. So
oh good, you're all prepared because I'm not. That's good. Okay, beginning of the show, guest gets to pick the intro, and you've heard the show a few times, so you know there's three different intros. There's the normal one. Mm-hmm. There's the one with Wyatt's Greg, and then there's the anti-ETH intro. Which one would you like?
Let's do the anti-ETH, because it has the Keel quote.
Yeah. Okay, here we go.
All right.
Hope you can hear it.
No, the
I can't hear it, but I remember what it sounds like.
Not a viable solution to this.
We need to go through a turning point in the study of this whole domain.
There we go.
Away from ideology. We're not here to prove that we're being visited by, you know, aliens from this planet or that star. That may very well be true, but we have not done the basic work.
I have this hunch that this phenomenon is comes from some sort of domain of pure information, and the fact that they can interact with us at all suggests that that we inhabit a domain that's also pure information.
Are we go conditioned here? Yes.
Interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso?
You know, I'm going to have to figure out a way to get to block out the Skype so that I can call people and not have to have the person be dropped right in the middle of the show right when it's happening, right when...
right you when have they, to get a... Do you have a mixer?
Yeah, I have a mixer, but the thing is, all my audio is coming out of one computer. I'd have to actually route Skype from a different computer, which I may do. Hmm. You know, I might... change this so that the Skype is coming out of a slightly different, a completely different computer than my main one, and then I've got a third computer just to broadcast.
Nice. Anyway,
yeah, it's kind of when I don't have the radio studio, it's and I have to make one in my own house. that's what happens. But you know, with this method, I'm actually able to. Broadcast from anywhere as long as it has Wi-Fi, and I have my laptop with me. So that's the trade-off. So tonight we're talking with Ren Collier. Is that how I pronounce your name?
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah, from the blog Liminal Room, which Josh Cutchin told me about. And what I told Ren the other day is that I was, as I was reading the latest entry from the 29th called His Name is Control from Liminal Room, I realized, is that a picture from the Dominator wreck? That's not, is it?
Oh, the banner?
Yeah.
Oh, no, that's actually the Sutro Baths in San Francisco.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right near the, whatever the name of that hotel is, Cliff House, hotel, mm-hmm. the restaurant.
Yep, exactly. Overlooks it.
Yeah. When I was reading through it, what I thought was, wow, this is like exactly like something I would write or would have written, you know, a few years ago, because I'm doing other things now, but it's like, you're reading the same stuff and kind of having the same ideas about things that I have. In furtherance of getting people on the show that either haven't been interviewed or have been under interviewed, I wanted to get in touch with you. And luckily he said yes right away. So
yeah, thanks. I mean, it's a fairly new blog. I've been listening to podcasts and, I've been reading UFO and paranormal related books for years now. And I just sort of finally decided to take the dive and start writing about the topic myself, because so many times I would listen to things and want to add something or, be a part of the conversation. So right. I guess I got tired of sitting on the sidelines.
Yeah. Well, that's what happens. You just kind of like, I'd really like to one, say something, and two, maybe even more importantly, interact with people that I want to interact with about this. Cause it's the only way it's the only way you go out and you can read books, but to really like start thinking and learning about stuff, you kind of have to contact people and talk to them.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's what we're doing right now. Anyway, so which books were you reading? Because I know I'm going to go, that one.
Well, I read probably about 6 months ago, I read Passport to Magonia for the first time.
Yeah.
And a lot of the stuff in Magonia, it was very eye-opening. But, I sort of had started to sort of think about the same things. Yeah, I'd known about the similarities between UFO contact and the fairy faith just from reading the Mothman prophecies when I was a kid over and over again. Kiel sort of brings up the folkloric aspect, although he doesn't go as nearly into depth as Jacques Vallée does in Passport to Magonia.
Yeah.
And I read a lot of abduction related stuff when I was younger. It was something that I was both terrified of and fascinated with when I was a kid. Read The Interrupted Journey, Communion. Those, I think, were the two big ones for me.
Okay. Missing Time?
Yeah, I didn't actually read any of Bud Hopkins' stuff until last year. I picked up a copy of Missing Time and a copy of Intruders. And I don't know. It's weird to read Hopkins' stuff because he's got a very materialistic nuts and bolts approach to it.
Which is weird since he was a abstract artist.
Yeah, really. It makes it a little tough to keep concrete ideas when I read it. Because, I have a sort of non-materialist view of the whole phenomena. But when you read Bud Hopkins' stuff, he's very persuasive with his arguments, and about finding implants and that sort of thing. And you start to think, well, what if this is a physical phenomena? So it's a good read. Intruders is really scary. I actually couldn't finish it because I got so freaked out by the contents. There's this one story in it about a woman who's watching TV in her apartment, and she looks out on the deck, and there's like these three grays standing there staring at her through a window. And then the TV turns into a gray's face and orders her to go outside, and she refuses to, and it starts to get angry with her and threaten her. And it's just, I just can't imagine anything scarier than that. It was just horrifying to read.
Yeah. And it's funny, you being so, what's the word? This is from Bud Hopkins' book, you said?
Yeah, this is from Intruders.
Right. Being so materialistic about it, he in his viewpoint of it, he's willing to accept that these things are going on with people, but their memories implanted by the aliens rather than anything that might be going on in their minds.
Yeah, exactly. He makes the argument for it. I don't end up agreeing with him in the end. I was actually, for most of today, reading John Mack's book, Abduction, which is an excellent, excellent book. I'm really enjoying it so far. And I think I prefer his approach to Bud Hopkins' approach, even though I have my reservations about the use of hypnosis.
Yeah.
But I mean, Mac makes a pretty good argument. At least, I guess with Mac, he's an MD. You know, he's trained, and I have less reservations about him using hypnosis. I have a lot more reservations about, you know, Bud Hopkins using it, not being a trained psychiatrist.
Yeah, the one thing I remembered from meeting with Mario Pozzaglini, the one thing he said in his and he was a psychologist. I mean, credentialed, doctored psychologist, very interested in this stuff. And he said the one thing I always notice is the people doing the abduction research, by and large, have little respect or understanding of the subconscious.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I sort of wonder if that's what led Hopkins to have such a nuts and bolts approach to it, to his theories about what was going on.
Right.
Whereas Mac, you know, from the beginning is like, you know, this seems to be non-materialist in nature.
But he did think that, as far as I remember, he did think that there was an external extraterrestrial source for the stuff.
He does think there is some sort of non-human intelligence interacting with these people. I don't think he thinks it's entirely from within. And, you know, I sort of agree with him a little bit on that. I mean, I'm at a point right now where I do think that there is some sort of non-human intelligence communicating with people, even if that non-human intelligence is generated by humans in the first place. But I believe there's an external factor going on. I mean, just the common threads that run through it, or throughout the phenomena going back into antiquity, is just too much. The coincidences are too much for me to say that, you know, it's an entirely subjective experience.
Yeah, exactly. I kind of struggled with that, and people say, well, do you think there's aliens here or not? And it's just like, well, it's way, way, way more complicated than that to me.
Mm-hmm.
But as you say, it's like there's so much going on for so long, and with such variety, and with such consistency across people that have never met, that you just kind of you kind of get pushed into the corner of There's something external to it. I mean, I'm willing to accept that there's an externality to what's going on, and build on that. But the thing is that, you know, after that, how much of it, you know, how after the thing comes in externally, what systems does it go through before you're kind of aware of what it is? You know, aware that something's coming in. You know.
Yeah, and I mean, on two levels, my kind of reasons for thinking that there is some sort of external reality to it is based on sort of two facts. The fact that there is physical evidence, not necessarily of extraterrestrials, but of some sort of physical phenomena occurring, like usually related to electromagnetism, whether it be burn marks, the whole implant thing. I don't really know what I think about it. Honestly, I've heard a lot of things about them, so I sort of reserved my judgment. But I've heard that they're also just calcifications. But I sort of wonder if those calcifications couldn't also be occurring because of some sort of physical phenomena going on that's inducing this altered state into people.
Yeah.
And like I was just looking, flipping through some of my notes from Interrupted Journey, and there's a section where Barney Hill realizes that his car is magnetized, or sections of the car are magnetized, where there's these sort of scoop marks. And so it's obvious something happened. I mean, the fact that, you know, cars refuse to start, electronics go wacky, sort of indicates some sort of electrical disturbance. And sort of the other thing that leads me to think there's an external element is the fact that there does seem to be an intelligence behind the phenomena. I mean, there seems to be some sort of purpose, even if that purpose is pretty hard to divine. But I mean, in the sort of intro to Mac's book, he talks about how UFO contactees are, in large parts, like the contact experience completely changes their life.
Right.
you know, it's almost like a religious or shamanic awakening in people. And I think back to all the, you know, religious and historical figures who were, you know, had some sort of like otherworldly contact experience. People like the Prophet Muhammad or Joan of Arc. I mean, even, you know, the parents of Jesus Christ were visited by, you know, an angel. And all of these sort of contact events seem to push people towards something. Mac talks about it increases people's empathy towards others, their openness towards, I guess, spirituality. And in my blog, I sort of make the guess, sort of, that maybe these sort of contact experiences had something to do with the formation of religion.
Right.
You know, I know that some, you know, there's a lot of different views on that. Some people think that psychedelic drugs, like mushrooms, I think Terrence McKenna
right.
said yeah. that was one of the precursors of religion. And maybe those are, you know, people report having contact-like experiences when using DMT. So maybe he's onto something there.
Yeah, I mean these signals come from a lot of places. It's just that you different people mm-hmm. need different tuning apparatus to do it, and some people just have them anyway. And sometimes probably the signal is just so strong that anybody would get it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, and it, what you say about electromagnetic energy, I mean, that's been various researchers have talked about that, Kiel and Valet. That there seems to be some incredibly strong electromagnetic source in whatever's going on with these things. And, you know, and not taking it past that. It's like, well, mm-hmm. there's a source of electromagnetic energy. It has effects on the physical environment, and it has psychological effects on the people that get close enough to it. And that's another key thing. I mean, the close encounter thing, 500 feet or less, or even closer. Mm-hmm. The closer people get to something, closer people get to this electromagnetic energy, the more effects it has upon them. And like that. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no, it's okay. Yeah. I mean, Mac also mentions the whole fact that the fact that people are contacted by light, you know, there's usually a light that then beams into somebody and then they have some sort of contact experience.
Oh yeah, we were talking about, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Well, I say generally it doesn't seem like the contact experience precedes the light, you know, generally the light's first and then there's a contact experience.
Yeah.
So almost like that light is the physical manifestation of whatever's going on.
Uh-huh. And whatever, you know, whatever is going on in the local environment there is maybe, you know, a mind or a group mind or a bunch of people trying to figure out what the hell it is. And then it becomes what people create it to be in the moment. I don't know. But the thing we were talking about when I called you a couple days ago on Friday was that you were, and I'd never really thought about this, that's what had happened to Travis Walton. He just got zapped by something that was very concentrated and strong, and it scrambled his brains a bit.
Yeah, I mean, in the description from Fire in the Sky, it's mentioned that, you know, they see this light, and Travis Walton goes out and observes the light, and then it hits him with some sort of beam that, you know, knocks him, you know, basically out of his shoes. It knocks him into the air, and his friends think he's dead. And so they, you know, they haul out of there.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, to me, as someone who grew up with a dad who was an electrician, that's sounds like he was hit by like an arc of electricity or something, or like lightning.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds awfully like that. And I mean, I don't have the facts on this. But you know, it's known that, you know, being hit by electricity like that can cause like amnesia. I would
it scrambles your brains.
Yeah, I would make a good bet that it probably can cause an altered state of consciousness.
Yeah.
At the very least, you know, if it doesn't kill you. And I've sort of always thought that, you know, while I don't think Travis Walton is lying about his experience, I think he experienced what he experienced from a subjective point of view.
Yes.
But I think the reason he wasn't there when people went and looked for him the next day was because he was wandering around, blasted out of his mind. He had like no idea what was going on, and basically in sort of some like a retrograde amnesiac state.
Yeah. We also, I mean, and when you said this to me, I said, hey, he was found near, he said he, you know, was, well, he said they found him near Heber, Arizona. I looked on a map between Snowflake and Heber, apparently, just those two towns, not exactly where he was, where he disappeared and where he reappeared, is by map distance 25 miles. And what was he gone for, like 3 or 4 days or something like that?
I think it was 4 days. I'd have to fact check myself on that, but I think it was 4 days.
You can very easily walk that distance in 4 days. Or three. But, you know, somebody might have an answer. It's like, well, with such treacherous, you know, whatever. But the thing is, he started walking at night. So who knows where he was and if indeed he was walking, which we're positing here.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, like I said before, it could be some kind of retrograde amnesia. Or not retrograde, anterograde amnesia.
Which means where, what?
Well, for a few days, he's not able to form new memories. Mm. And so, like, he's conscious and he's, like, walking, you know, to town. He's trying to get back to town. He's probably hurt and confused.
Right.
But the reason he doesn't remember anything is because his brain has been damaged in such a way that he's unable to form any new memories for a few days. Which is, you know, a documented thing that can happen to people.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, he may have had this whole hallucination about the alien abduction scenario, you know, during his trip back to town. And since that's the only thing he could remember, well, that's what he thought happened to him.
Right. Yeah. This is, you know, pure speculation, but it's interesting speculation to me because of the fact that I've never really heard any, there might've been somebody that's mentioned this, but I haven't heard it.
Go ahead. You know, I sort of brought up that idea because, you know, I find Eric Ouellet's ideas really fascinating on this topic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like his whole theory of the UFO phenomena being related to some sort of, you know, energetic quality of the Earth, like Earth lights or something, and how some of the phenomena might be related to like poltergeist phenomena. And you know, I think he may be onto something. I mean, there's this obvious electromagnetic effect. The only thing that I'm, I guess, on the fence about and confused about is the fact that the lights seem to have some sort of intelligence, usually.
Right.
I think one really fascinating aspect of that is that sometimes I've heard reports of them responding to human thought. Or like somebody, you know, thinks something and then the light seems to notice them.
Right.
I mean, that's absolutely fascinating.
It would be interesting to look at other, you know, what's the word? See, we're kind of edging towards this Michael Persinger thing a little bit. And Persinger, of course, he discovered something that, you know, electromagnetic fields, strong ones around the brain cause, what's the word, liminal experiences?
Yeah, liminal experiences.
And so he thinks that that's the whole explanation for UFO, all UFO sightings, at least close encounter ones, and explains everything school always bothers me.
Yeah, I mean, because not everything fits into those boxes. I mean, I'm kind of...
Nothing we'll talk about will ever fit into every box.
Yeah, there's always going to be outliers, and I'm kind of the opinion right now, at least, that there is no unified field theory of the paranormal, and there's never going to be because it's not one phenomenon. I believe that there's several things happen, some of them purely psychological, some of them physical, and perhaps some of them metaphysical. You know,
Right.
They're not all going to fit into the same category.
Yeah, and we're making categories here because that's how human brains work.
Yeah, in order to analyze it, we've got to categorize it.
Yeah,
in some way, and even though you know it resists categorization a lot of the time.
And the fact that we're categorizing it means I think we're pulling it a remove or two or three away from whatever it is. But
For sure.
How the hell else are we going to meet it? And I don't know if we can meet it on its own terms because it's not, like you said, it refuses categorization.
Well, something, again, I mentioned in my blog entry was that perhaps we don't have the mental faculties to understand it.
Right.
You know, like, for instance, you can't explain what a three-dimensional object looks like in two dimensions. All you can see is a cross-section.
Right.
similar to like we can't visualize a four-dimensional cube. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just simply impossible. We can't. But what you can do is you can visualize the shadow of a four-dimensional cube, because a shadow of something is separated by one dimension down.
Right.
And so similar to the UFO phenomena, we may not be able to ever fully understand the truth behind it or what's really going on, but perhaps we can look at its shadows.
Yeah. And the thing is that we're looking at shadows and then going through a giant mental, infinite mental book of trying to figure out what those shadows look like. Well, that shadow looks like this thing. So that shadow looks like a pair of scissors. So it must be a pair of scissors.
As cliche as it is, it's just like the allegory of the cave. You know, we're looking at shadows on the wall.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Plato or Aristotle or whoever first came up with that. Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. So we're looking at a shadow of reality anyway, but then we're looking at something that seems to not conform to the rest of everything that we consider reality. And so mm-hmm. you try to talk about it in the same way as the other parts of the reality, and it doesn't work. I have people like you and talk to people that seem to be trying to push towards, we know it's a shadow. Can we infer something about it by its shadow and perhaps what we inject into the meaning? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And yeah, and I think the shadows that we can, kind of qualify and quantify are the, the physical evidence aspects of the phenomena, the mythological and folkloric context in which it appears, and our inferences based on that. And I think, too, as we further our understanding of the human brain, that's going to be an enormous eye-opener as far as the phenomena is concerned. I mean, that's sort of why Persinger's work, I think, is important, even mm-hmm. if I don't think it's the answer.
Right.
And, his work with the God Helmet, it mirrors DMT experiences.
Right.
But maybe those experiences aren't generating the phenomena. Perhaps they're simply opening the door for that phenomena to be able to establish a communications link with us.
Right, right.
I mean, didn't McKenna also say that, the best sort of long distance space communication tool or colonization tool you could use would be spores?
Yeah.
And so that's why he believed that, the psilocybin mushroom was like was not native to this planet. I don't know if I necessarily believe that, but it's a fun idea.
Yeah. Oh, Daniel says there's nothing on the Shout Cheap link. Well, I was about to say, Daniel, go to it since he can't hear me.
Yeah, it might be tough for him to follow your instructions.
Yeah, let me help Daniel out. He was the one of the people on the clown pop-up podcast the other day.
Oh man, that clown stuff is really scary.
Yeah, let me answer him. It's kind of a know how in between or how liminal the clown thing is. I mean, I'm almost certain it's like the earlier, Coleman said about the killer clowns, that there's a flap of them and it's something that's happening, but I don't know if they're actual flesh and blood things.
I'm almost certain that the clown stuff that's being reported right now is flesh and blood.
Really?
It sounds too physical in nature. I mean, it's not even a good clown costume. It's like a guy in a black jacket with like a clown mask on.
That makes even more sense to me as something that because it's not exactly what you would expect it to be.
Yeah.
And the other weird thing about it is you'd think somebody would have been shot by now.
That's true. But you never know. People are strange, but I'm so cynical that I've been almost thinking that it's a viral marketing campaign for the new It remake.
We talked about that, and I was thinking, do you know how badly in trouble that production company would be when they found out that's what it is?
Oh, man, people have done way worse in viral marketing campaigns.
Really? So have they?
I don't put it beyond people.
What's a worse one?
Well, it's not exactly viral marketing, but I remember when the video game Dark Souls came out, the marketing team held this big banquet at one of the big gaming conventions and had like a real severed goat's head that as part of the buffet and stuff, and it's just like everyone threw a huge fit over it. I just generally think marketing people are some of the worst people alive.
They are pretty bad, but the thing is, that was contained. This is something that's actually called the police out, screwed around with people, scared them, and cost money in real dollars with all the law enforcement out there looking for them. So I think if that, you know, if they were caught or said, yeah, this was us, or somehow owned up to it and said, this is for our show, that's, you know, Greenville and all those cities would come after them saying, good, now we're suing you for $3 million because that's how much it costs for us to try and check out all this crap that you were pulling on us.
Yeah, but the publicity would be worth the $3 million in the lawsuit.
Maybe.
You know, I actually just remembered one sort of like that where I think Cartoon Network got in hot water when they were doing a sort of viral marketing campaign for Aqua Teen Hunger Force many years ago, where they had
In Boston or whatever it was?
Yeah, in Boston, where they placed the little Moonanite, like little TVs with their pictures on them, like under the bridge or something.
Yeah.
And they called out the bomb squad, and it was a giant snafu. But, and, you know, they sued them, but it was also great advertisement. So, I mean, you think about these companies would spend $3 million on an advertising campaign anyway, so...
Yeah, I guess so. Maybe they'll just keep, you know, they'll just keep doing it until they get sued out of existence or to the point where they can't afford it.
Yeah.
Where they can't afford it. I don't know. I get you could be right. I never really thought about that. But I also still maintain, why hasn't somebody been caught or shot yet? They're incredibly lucky if they haven't been.
Well, are you familiar with the Chocolaca monster?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, here's a good cryptid Lauren Coleman style story for you.
Sounds maybe familiar if I want to be cool about it, but I don't know anything about it.
The Daily Show actually ran a segment on it. They had to they had to subtitle the locals because their southern accents are so thick you couldn't understand them. But it happened near where I grew up, actually. There's a creek out there called Chocolaca Creek. It's incredibly polluted by the local Monsanto Corporation insecticide plant, so much so that they were finding mutated fish in the creek. And apparently, I don't remember, this is the 1980s or 1970s. I can't remember the exact date, but there is a guy. Well, okay. There were a lot of reports of a monster that was like jumping out and scaring people who were driving down the road that goes by Chocolate Creek late at night. Several people reported it, and it was supposed to be like a hairy creature with like a skull, cow skull head. And it was this one lady said it swooped down out of the trees and like it could fly, and it dive bombed her car. And it became like sort of a local thing.
Starting to sound like a Scooby-Doo episode, but go ahead.
Yeah, it got big enough that people started forming hunting parties and like staking it out.
Yeah,
and you know, after these kind of, you know, groups of guys were going out with guns, it mysteriously disappeared and never showed up again.
Yeah,
and years later, it turned out that was because it was a guy with a cow skull and a fur robe. He was just jumping out and scaring people.
And, for the hell of it?
Yeah, basically because it was funny. And he decided that, you know, when people were out there with rifles, he needed to sort of give up the game and not go out and beat the Chocolaca monster anymore.
Ah, okay. Yeah, but the people in South Carolina, in fact, one of the people interviewed said she had a carry permit. And concealed carry permit. So she said, she said, when I saw this, I didn't actually have the gun with me. But, you know, if she's got one, and she lives in the apartments or whatever out there, there's other people that have them. And you know they're just waiting for somebody to, you know, and it's still going on.
Has it made any more appearances, though? I'm wondering if whoever was doing it sort of got the fear of God in them and decided that it wasn't worth scaring little kids anymore.
Yeah, I think it's still going on. Somebody can correct me. It's still going on. It has spread, though. It's spread to other places. Oh, Josh Cutchin says, attaboy, Ren.
Wow, so it's actually spreading, so it's popping up. Other people are reporting clowns.
Yep. Wow. Other people in other communities, other states, and it's there's So either people are catching on and trying to copy it, or just the phenomenon is spreading. I have a, you know, like I said, I still have a feeling that there's a paranormal aspect to it.
That's interesting. The spreading of it's interesting. I mean, because, yeah, that does sort of, I thought it was just one apartment complex and just one person that these people were seeing. But if it's like spreading around, it's some sort of folie de, that's interesting.
It's, well, it's folie whatever, hundreds yeah. now.
Exactly. Folie mille.
Yeah. A mille, yeah.
Yeah.
And during the show, when we were talking about Daniel or Skyler said, Steve Ray says it's just been three cities right now.
Oh, okay. I mean, even that's kind of weird.
Yeah. But while we were talking about it, nothing fresh for days right now. Okay, so it's calmed down a bit. But, you know, it was hot and heavy for, like, what, 3 weeks, a month?
Well, you know, given... Well, let's put it in the context of other sort of flaps. I mean, have there been also other cryptid sightings, UFO sightings in the areas as well?
Not contemporaneously, but apparently Greenville. The thing is, because Daniel put this up, he said, look, here from UFO, what was it called? Oh, it's on my, from UFO Stalker.
Mm-hmm.
Which is basically they take the information from either MUFON or I think the UFO Reporting Center and plot them on a map.
Mm-hmm.
If you look around there, there's like a bunch of UFO sightings all the way around for... I'm looking at the map on here. I don't know what the scale is. It's probably at least, tens of miles. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16... In the generally south, north, is I think that's the northwestern area of North Carolina or South Carolina. So I don't know, and I don't know the days, times, or whatever. I mean, I don't know how far back this stuff goes.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I wanted to ask Daniel, and I didn't, was would you not think that if you looked anywhere on a map of the United States, especially around population centers, there would be a history of sightings of strange things in the sky?
Probably, yeah. Because nobody's going to be reporting stuff where there's nobody to see it.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. If this stuff was recent or people were seeing other things, I'd be even more intrigued. The first thing he said was, look at this map. And I said, that's pretty interesting, which is why I had him on the show.
Hmm.
But, you know, correlation isn't causation. But the other thing I'd be interested to know is if in other clown... you know, flaps, if there were other things going on, because, you know, obviously everybody listening here knows that, you know, UFO sightings sometimes involve Bigfoot and other things.
Yeah, or other cryptids, large birds, anomalous humanoids, all kinds of weird stuff usually happens all around the same area. And it's something I'd mentioned to you the other night, too. You know, I'd be interested in having, you know, physical data about the environment there during these flaps, like seismic data.
Yeah.
Geological data, weather data, like what's going on in the environment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, could we possibly map these things based on physical effects?
Right. And of course, people are going to make the incredible assumption that when you mention that, it means, well, it's nothing but.
You know? Not necessarily. I mean,
no. Well, like well, said, people
correlation
that,
doesn't equal causation.
Right, right. But there are people that are going to say, "Well, it's nothing but, what's the word? A tectonic strain or something that is causing electromagnetic fields or something." This is Persinger's idea. Electromagnetic fields that are affecting people's brains. Therefore, they're seeing whatever. Which I don't think that's what you're saying at all. It's just kind of like, I wonder what the data says and what it might tell us by, with any correlations we could make. Not worrying about it, whether it's causation or not. Just making the correlations and see where they fall.
Exactly. I mean, like we were talking about the other night, in order for you to make any sort of honest analysis of anything, you have to gather as much data as possible. And like I mentioned before, hey, if it turned out that it is just electromagnetic fields or anomalies caused by tectonic strain that's scrambling people's brains, well, that's an answer. It's not necessarily as interesting as other answers, but an answer is an answer. Move on with our lives.
Yeah, and just because something is scrambling somebody's brain, as we talked about earlier, it may have to do with a tuning mechanism, you know?
Yeah,
maybe you're seeing something that's there or can only be seen in a certain state of mind. I don't know.
Exactly. Maybe it's not necessarily causing the phenomena, but rather just opening up the doors to it.
Yeah.
Just or, like, you know, taking psychedelics can open up the door to it.
Right.
Or, you know, meditation. I mean, I'm someone who's had both voluntary and involuntary out-of-body experiences like my entire life.
Oh, really? So, okay, because this is, you know, this is one of the questions. What got you interested in the first place? And I neglected to ask that question. So let me ask it now. And okay, please go ahead.
Well, I mean, I had a copy of the Mott Denn Prophecies from the time I was like 6 years old.
Uh-oh.
So while, you know, other kids were like playing on jungle gyms, I was, you know, like reading through the Mott Denn Prophecies.
Me too.
In third grade.
Me too, actually. Yep.
And like, you know, I had all kinds of books on UFOs. It was something that always fascinated me when I was a kid. I used to have recurring dreams where I would wake up in the middle of the night and there would be strange lights outside my window. And I would go outside and everyone in my neighborhood would be outdoors, like looking up, and I would look up and there would be, you know, millions and millions of ships in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I would have dreams about, you know, I started watching The X-Files. That came out when I was like in sixth grade. And, you know, I watch Sightings and all Unsolved Mysteries and all these shows about this topic. I was sort of immersed in it as a kid. And like I mentioned in my blog, it kind of scared me to the point where like my parents sort of banned me from having anything UFO related because I couldn't go to sleep at night anymore.
Right.
I was so terrified.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's at the beginning of your your essay there. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, eventually I ended up getting back into it several years ago. Actually, the whole reason I found Radio Mysterioso and some other podcasts I listened to is I was taking these long drives back and forth to Virginia from Atlanta. Because my girlfriend was in a residency in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I would take these long car rides when I got off from work at like 9 p.m. and drive all night and get there in the morning on the weekends.
Perfect.
And,
perfect,
you know,
time
to
listen.
Do.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I was like, why don't I just listen to paranormal stuff? So I remembered, you know, that Whitley Strieber had a podcast. So I would look up, you know, YouTube videos of Dreamland with episodes of like Linda Moulton Howe and, you know, eventually ended up, you know, finding Radio Mysterioso and some other podcasts, and just it kind of got me back into the topic. I started collecting books on it again and reading some books. That's about the same time I picked up Bud Hopkins Intruders. And, you know, I'd never really, I had sort of, I guess because pop culture permeates the ETH so heavily, like it's such a major aspect of every sort of pop culture relating around UFOs.
Yeah.
That I'd assumed that the ETH was sort of a given, and that, you know, I didn't necessarily think that it was the right answer because, you know, I'd read Keel so many times, but I didn't know that there was anyone else saying that. I think the closest I'd found to the Mothman prophecies when I read Nick Redfern's Three Men Seeking Monsters, which is that's such a good book. It's my favorite Nick Redfern book.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Cause it's just like gonzo, paranormal investigation.
Yeah.
It's such just like an entertaining read. And, you know, he sort of says some of the same things Keel does. You know, he sort of comes to this conclusion that this stuff is all related, that it doesn't necessarily seem to be extraterrestrial in origin. But again, that was the only, you know, I didn't hear anybody else saying these things. And then I started listening to your show and other shows, and I was like, wow, actually, a lot of people are saying that the ETH is probably bunk.
Yeah, or it's not, you know, I don't, at first I was like, oh, it's a bunch of crap, you know, I'm sick of it. And now I'm just kind of like, I don't like it as an explanation because it's no fun.
Well, you know, it just doesn't, like, I'm somebody that cares a lot about space exploration, and I think a lot about exobiology.
Right.
And the morphology of a gray alien doesn't make any sense at all. If we ever run into another, like, a physical organic alien life form, I'm almost going to guarantee you they're not going to look anything like a human.
Why is that? I mean, I think I agree with you, but why do you think that?
Just unless they grew, unless they evolved on a planet that was almost a direct duplicate of Earth, then I just can't see it being just this massive coincidence that their morphology ends up being similar to ours in any way. I mean, there are some givens that you could probably say, like, they would probably have eyes or at least some way of gathering visual information.
Right.
And generally, this is Earth-centric thinking, but...
Yeah, well, what else can you do but you try?
Yeah, given the context that we have, you're going to imagine that an alien life form is probably going to be a predator of some sort. Because generally...
predators survive where herbivores are less in control of their destiny.
Well, yeah, and generally predators are the more intelligent. They have to be more intelligent than their prey.
Right.
Right, so just by the nature of predation, predators end up being the most intelligent species on the planet.
Right.
So if we're running into another space-faring civilization, they probably are predators, or at least were in their past.
Right.
So they're probably going to have forward-facing eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. You know, this is all just like...
Yeah, I know. I mean, we haven't really talked about this on the show. Mm-hmm. And because I don't necessarily disagree with you. Mm-hmm. I'm... my idea after doing a bit of thinking on this is like that Arrival movie coming out where the mm-hmm. whatever it is are, they're intelligent. They have, I think what they are is, I read the short story courtesy mm-hmm. of Josh
mm-hmm.
and they have eyes. I think in the short story, they have eyes all the way around there. They're like round and they mm-hmm. have eyes all the way around the circumference of the center, part. And then they're like, there's a brain or something above it. And then underneath it, there's tentacles, like seven arms. So you're thinking, mm-hmm. you know, maybe some kind of octopoid that's developed a way to live so that it doesn't have to be underwater because it needs to manipulate things.
Yeah, so it's going to have limbs that it uses to manipulate things, obviously, especially if they have tools. It's going to have some sort of digit to manipulate tools.
Yeah, or tentacles or something that can grasp with some dexterity and delicateness.
Yeah, there are some givens. It's just like the morphology is going to largely depend on... I mean, human morphology is mostly just... I wouldn't say it's a mistake, but it just sort of happened to end up that way. You know, this just happened to be the sort of combination of things that worked out. And any alien morphology would be sort of the similar idea, just, you know, for whatever planet it evolved on. You know, that's why I think... As much as I've sort of grown out of H.P. Lovecraft's writing, I think that, you know, I read a lot of Lovecraft when I was younger, and I feel like he was onto something as far as his aliens were concerned, like the Elder Race or the Great Race of Yith. They're all sort of, you know, none of them look human at all. You know, they're all sort of like radial symmetry, starfish,
yeah,
you know, weirdo kind of things. And I feel like that's what we run into. Like, there's a really great...
part of that means I think it's just creepy for people, which was what part of the reason why he used those that morphology. But go ahead.
Mm-hmm. There's a really great first contact sci-fi novel by Peter Watts called Blindsight. You can buy Blindsight in bookstores. I think it was actually published by Tor, but there was a big falling out between him and the publisher, so he just put it for free on his website. So if you really want to read it, you can read it on his website.
Oh, okay.
I have a physical copy because I like it so much, but it's basically a first contact type novel, but it explores human consciousness in a way that a lot of sci-fi doesn't. And the aliens in it are truly, truly alien. And sort of the way he describes the way they communicate, like I don't want to spoil anything in case people actually want to read Blindsight, but...
Well, now I want to read it. Go ahead. Spoil it. I don't mind.
Are you familiar with the concept of a Chinese room?
Probably not, but if you start describing it, I might remember.
Okay, well, a Chinese room is a sort of thought experiment in which you have a sealed-off room with an operator inside. This person sort of has like a hole in the wall in which they receive like a book, like printed instructions, right? These are all in a language that they have no context for and don't understand at all.
Oh, okay. There's something similar like this called Mary's Room.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thought experiment, is that somebody is in a room and the only contact they have with the outside are instruments which show them what it's like outside and how they would interpret what was outside their box through instruments rather than direct contact, you know, physically. But go ahead.
Mm-hmm. So the Chinese Room, similar to that. So the person, let's say that the language that you're getting is Chinese into the room.
Right.
You know, they get a sheaf of instructions in Chinese. They don't understand Chinese at all. They don't speak it. They have no context for it. But they do have a book that gives them instructions on how to reply to the instructions that have been sent. Okay. It doesn't translate it for them. It just tells them, if you see this combination of letters, reply with, you know, if you receive X, you know, X characters, reply with Y characters. You know, they get their instructions, they fill it out based on their book that tells them what to put in the, you know, check boxes, and they send it back. Now, to the person on the receiving end who gets these, you know, these instructions once they leave the room, it's going to look like the person inside speaks Chinese.
But they're insane.
But they don't. Yeah, they don't speak Chinese. They just know how to put the letters together.
Yeah.
But they don't know what they're saying back.
Right.
And, you know, I honestly think this is a really great sort of thought experiment to apply to the UFO phenomena.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, what if the UFO phenomena is a Chinese room? What if something's communicating with us using symbols and folklore and memes and tropes and archetypes that it pulls from our subconscious, but it really has no idea what it's telling us?
Yeah.
You know, it's just...
Or we're pulling it because we're responding to a stimulus.
Yeah, you know... That's something I brought up on my blog again, too. You know, while I think, well, it at least appears on the surface, just like in a Chinese room, that the phenomena has some sort of purpose. What if it doesn't? What if it doesn't know
as
what
we,
it's telling
as
us?
We understand it?
Yeah. What if we're pulling the purpose from it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what if we're just projecting onto the whole experience? You know, maybe there is really something trying to communicate with us, but... You know, like a truly alien race, we don't have any context for understanding what it's saying, and it doesn't have any way to talk to us. I mean, I'm sure that I know Josh got me excited about The Arrival. I really need to read the short story, but I think it kind of gets into some of the same ideas. Like, how would you communicate with a truly alien intelligence?
Yeah. It gets a little specific. Mm-hmm. And what it does, I think, and I haven't read the whole story, I'm about halfway through it, but what mm-hmm. it does is it describes how you might go about figuring out something that is incomprehensible by mm-hmm. looking for patterns, because their spoken language is quite different from their written language. And the scientist, the linguist, spends time just sitting with them and having them run around this room and pointing at things and then writing things down. And that, I don't know how they're going to, you know, handle mm-hmm. that in the movie, but I think it'll be pretty good because the director is apparently pretty sharp, and I can't remember mm-hmm. the last couple things he did, but he's directing the Blade Runner, the new Blade Runner mm-hmm. too.
Yeah. See, ultimately, I mean, it's kind of what I'm getting at too, though, is that even if you can recognize patterns, it doesn't mean that you understand. I mean, a Chinese room is all about patterns. It's about pattern recognition. You know, you could trick somebody into thinking that you could speak English if you listen to English long enough and were able to figure out, you know, that's just like a, you know, like chatbots, like artificial intelligence.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they don't know what they're saying. They don't know how to speak English. You know, they're just replying to set patterns that they've been programmed with. You know, they don't actually know what they're saying back to you, even though if, you know, eventually maybe they'll reach a point one day where it may seem like you're talking. You know, there may be things that can pass the Turing test one day, but it still doesn't mean they know what they're saying.
No, unless they're, yeah. It depends on the level of AI that you have behind it and mm-hmm. how well it recognizes words and how they're put together and all that. I mean, a sufficiently high enough level of AI, I guess, what's it called? I can't remember what it's called. There's like the level we're at now, and then there's one that's like a human level, which will be like this huge breakthrough. And then very quickly after that, probably within days, it'll be way beyond that.
Well, you know, it kind of brings up ideas about just, you know, human language. Like we were talking about this the other night, too. There's a sort of context to human language when we speak to one another, that there's a lot of, you know, empathic, unspoken, nonverbal communication that goes on that supplements the verbal communication. I think even in written communications to other people, there's that some of that context somehow is preserved, even though you're not there to see it.
Yeah, and it's kind of language specific too, obviously, because it, if you grew up in the culture, you know what the contexts are.
Yeah, so I mean, it's going to. I mean, I don't know. I honestly hope that there's AI one day that can replicate that, because I think it's important for the advancement of our race. But it's something that I'm not sure can actually be done, unless, you know, the human brain is 100% emulated on every level by some sort of hardware.
Yeah, well, that's the or software, and that's, I think that's what's being worked towards.
Yeah. Geez, there's some really interesting stuff regarding emulation of mind states going on recently. It's really simple first steps, but it's fascinating. There was a guy who was able to completely replicate the neural, like, sort of framework of a nematode worm.
Yes. Yes.
Did you see that video?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes,
he
created
like a little Lego. Robot.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he had like the visualization. You could see all the synapses firing and everything, and he would turn it on, and the little nematode would look for, or, you know, the robot AI nematode controlling the Lego robot would try to find light, because that's what, you know, nematodes do.
Right.
And, geez, that just brings up all kinds of crazy questions. Like, when he turns the power off and resets it, does he kill it? Is it a new nematode each time he does that?
Yeah.
Does it form memory? I mean, it's such a simple neural network that maybe these are questions that don't necessarily apply.
Yeah, it's probably just automatic responses that are part of the hardware or whatever you want to call it.
But once you start getting more complicated than that, you know, what happens when we simulate the mind of a, you know, let's say like a cockroach or, you know, an insect?
Yeah.
Each time you turn on that simulation and then you stop it, is that killing? You know, is it actually an intelligent being at that point? Because from a objective standpoint, is it any different than, you know, another insect?
Yeah.
Even it's just in different hardware.
Yeah. I created you, therefore I can kill you.
Yeah. And the androids dream of electric sheep and et cetera.
Yeah. I haven't finished the book. I started reading it and then I got sidetracked with, you know, 15 other books, but there's one called, Our Final Invention. And it's basically about AI, and the guy is not an alarmist, but he's very concerned. And you know, he talks about people that are way more concerned than he is, and also a lot of people that aren't as concerned at all, like Ray Kurzweil, who's all for it.
I think I'm part of the Kurzweil group. I don't necessarily agree with Kurzweil on a lot of things, but
yeah.
I'm someone who is not frightened at all by the prospect of artificial intelligence. I mean, this kind of ties back into what I was talking about earlier about, you know, if we run into extraterrestrial life.
Yeah.
The reason I qualified it as organic is I don't think we're going to run into organic extraterrestrial life unless the life itself evolved in the vacuum of space.
Yeah, I think I saw a news report about this recently. Who was arguing about this? Was saying that if we do encounter any, it's going to be robots.
I mean, unless
they could be sentient robots, but robots nevertheless.
Yeah, unless it is an organism that evolved and developed in the vacuum of space, which we don't think is possible right now, according to our current understanding of biology.
Yeah.
It or some disembodied intelligence, which is way more, you know, woo-woo and metaphysical, or it. Will be, you know, maybe it's an organism that has been engineered to survive in space.
Right.
But I think the much more, but you know, if it's something that's engineered, it's basically a robot, even if it's made using organics. But that turns into the thing where organics aren't meant to be in space. I mean, we're already learning just from the very brief time that astronauts are in space.
Weird things happen.
It wrecks havoc on them. I mean, like biologically, like they get incredible doses of radiation. It screws up their eyesight, their bone structure. I mean, it's just, we're not, that's why I think the idea of extended human exploration of space is probably a pipe dream, unless we genetically engineer people to specifically survive in a weightless, you know, like space environment.
Yeah. Obviously. Yeah. That's something that Burroughs wrote about, which we will get to in a minute.
Yeah. So, I mean, I really think that if we run into other organisms in space, they're going to be probably artificial intelligences inhabiting some sort of mechanical body. Because you send a mechanical body into space, well, you don't have to worry about any of all the stuff that plagues organics. I mean, who cares if it's weightless?
Yeah. Upload your whatever, your race's experience into one or two or 10 or whatever units. And also have them, you know, self-replicating or self-repairing, or they can repair each other or whatever.
Exactly. You know, Charles Strauss's sort of novella Accelerando was all about this concept about how, you know, the ships in Accelerando are just Coke can-sized spaceships that have, you know, an entire crew of artificial intelligences.
Right.
You know, and it works out. It's fine. You know, like, I believe that artificial intelligence is going to be the first step in that, because why send something out into space if it can't appreciate it? But in the end, I believe that sort of the destiny of mankind lies in within, you know, the realm of silicon and you know, carbon composite, not necessarily flesh and blood.
Yeah, transcending in an artificial way till you don't know the difference anymore. At that point, who knows? There's some sort of war or whatever the hell it is environmental disaster that the machines won't really care. They just put more shielding around themselves, and they don't care about radiation or maybe even about heat or cold. But
yeah, I mean, I think it's an important thing for us to be looking on, even just for the preservation of you know, sort of the same sort of intelligence that we have on this planet. Because, yeah, you're right. An ecological disaster could spell the end of the human race, but wouldn't necessarily spell the end of
human consciousness.
Race. Yeah, exactly. And human consciousness can be preserved through these actions. It's something that I'm pretty passionate about, but, you know, it's something that's also, I think, a long ways down the road, because we're just now sort of getting into the realm of the most basic sort of artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
But it does something. I mean, Kurzweil's idea about the singularity, right? It basically revolves around what happens when you have an artificial intelligence that can improve itself.
Yeah.
You know,
and then it doesn't need humans anymore.
It's not just that it doesn't need humans anymore, but that creates an infinite feedback loop within itself.
Mm.
It starts accelerating its own improvement at an exponential rate.
Yeah. That's what I said about, you know, 5 minutes after human level AI comes up, then the idea is, you know, superior AI, unlimited AI will happen because it just, like you said, it creates a feedback loop where it gets rid of everything that's not working, keeps everything that does. Which you can do in, you know, milliseconds. So,
And people are sort of afraid of. I don't understand the sort of fear behind it, because people are like, okay, well, it's going to get rid of humanity. But I'm sort of like, why? Like, what? Why would it do that? What reason would it have? I don't understand why it couldn't coexist with humanity. Ian Banks' wonderful, wonderful novel *Fearsome Engine* sort of talks about this a lot. If anything, that AI would simply retreat into its own little sort of cyber universe that it's created for itself. I mean, it wouldn't even have any need to exist in the physical realm, you know?
That's true. Yeah, that I've never really heard about that, because, you know, I'm reading this fear-mongering thing where it says, well, if it deems it useful, it does, and it doesn't need humans, and the humans can work as, you know, something to provide more material for whatever it needs to do. Or either that, or it's like, we need to make more of whatever this thing is. Well, okay, then it doesn't really matter what people think or humans think. We just need more of this thing. And, you know, meanwhile, people are having their, you know, all their food taken away, or their limbs ripped off, or their cars are running into each other, or all the, you know, everything that runs on the internet just starts... is pushed towards, let's make more of whatever this thing, or towards this goal, and we don't care what humans need. So that's the idea behind the scary side of AI.
Yeah, sort of the von Neumann Grey Goo disaster scenario.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that. I mean, I can see where people are coming from with that. I believe that a self-improving artificial intelligence would end up becoming like the universe's greatest solipsist. You know, I think it would retreat into its own self infinitely, like holding up a mirror to another mirror.
Yeah. Steve says, won't it need humans to maintain the server farm?
It will, but, you know, I think that
I don't think it does. I think if it's intelligent enough, it can do all these things in an automated way, and then, you know, and as you say, maybe it doesn't matter. It'll just retreat into, those electrons need to be stored somewhere.
Well, it'll be limited by the amount of energy that is provided it for processing power, and it'll be limited by its hardware.
Create its own hardware or demand more energy from wherever energy is being created?
Well, it could demand it, but it doesn't mean it's going to get it. I mean, it's sort of only going to take what we put into it. You know, I work with, like virtual servers and stuff, and you can increase them and put however many, you know, however much RAM and however much processing power you want into them, but it can't, you know, just get it for itself.
Well, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, like, it's sort of the idea of the Matryoshka brain, you know, like the idea that, the Dyson sphere concept, that what reason would you have to have a Dyson sphere? You know, even a small fraction of a Dyson swarm would be enough to provide all the energy a million times over that our planet currently needs.
Yeah.
So what would you use the energy of a star for? And there you go. You'd use it for that thing's processing power.
Right. So the idea of the I'm sorry if I'm backtracking or, you know.
No, it's okay.
The idea of a that was presented in I can't remember the name of the author, but in Our Last Invention was that you could, that whatever it is fine as long as it's enclosed within a physical place that does not allow it access to the internet. As soon as it gets access to outside of where it is, it doesn't need anybody to teach it anything anymore. It just goes and pulls the entire collected intelligence of the human race in, and then decides what it needs to do to perpetuate itself. That's the fear. What do you think stops that?
Well, that's sort of making the assumption that it isn't already occurring.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's already occurring with a lot of, I mean, you look at a lot of Google's project, like, you remember their image project that would, where, you know, this AI that they created would, you basically use the entire Google Images database to make its own images. You know,
right. Yeah, the ones that made the very strange looking. It would extrapolate from what it thought something looked like, and, you know.
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of already happening. Those AIs are already developing. I mean, they're infants, but, you know, I think that we should plug it into the internet. I mean, I think it's the only way for it to really, for the singularity to sort of occur, is it's going to have to plug in and get all that information. It's just going to, there's going to be like ethical questions that come up in terms of like,
that the AI cares about.
Yeah. I mean, also too, you're also thinking that, okay, well, I think there's a lot of fear mongering involved.
Like, yes, I know there is. I want to get past that and see what people have to say, because fear mongering gets you nowhere. I want to know what people think on both sides of the issue without the emotion attached to it.
I think people are scared that, okay, well, just because an AI gets on the internet, it's going to, you know, immediately jack into your Nest thermometer and freeze you to death inside of your apartment. And I'm sort of like, but why? Like, why would it care about you? It's sort of like,
No. The point is, it doesn't care about you. It cares about its own its own purpose, whatever that might be. And there would be one programmed into it, or a self-perpetuating or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the idea was it's a race to figure out how to have the AI be ethical, I guess the word is, with things that aren't it.
Well, you know, also too, it's going to be relying ultimately on the sort of energy grid that the planet has, and the sort of, you know, the internet itself. I mean, a lot of people know this, so I don't want to sound like I'm just mansplaining things here, but you know, the internet isn't like one giant organism. You know, the internet is a huge disparate collection of networks that are run by different telecommunications providers and organizations and regulatory agencies. It's not one thing like some people imagine it is.
It's a net.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's literally a network, and it's just an extremely large network. So I just, even if, like, as someone who works for telecom, I know, and somebody who works in internet security, I know that even if, let's say, an AI gets out of the lab and starts hopping across the internet, it can't just hop across the internet. I mean, there are firewalls that would block it at certain points. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you get into a lot of nuts.
But it's so smart,
here.
It could figure out how to get around the firewall.
Maybe.
You know, there's all these arguments in Our Last Invention book, and they go through these things you're talking about one by one, and I don't know if I believe him. But, he talks to people that are far more involved in the development of those things than he is, or I am, or anybody I know. So that's, you know, I'm reading the fear-mongering book, and so next I should probably read the non-fear-mongering book.
I don't know what the non-fear-mongering book would be. Maybe one of Kurzweil's books.
But, yeah, probably.
I mean, Kurzweil's whole, I guess, you know, in-game idea is that, we're going to be able to upload our consciousness to the web.
Right.
And, you know, live forever in our cyber paradise. But I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, it's sort of the age-old, like, transporter question from Star Trek. You know, like, is it really Captain Kirk, you know, each time? Or is it just a copy of Captain Kirk and the original's blown to pieces each time he's transported? You know, is he dying and each one's a new copy?
Yeah.
You know, if you upload your brain to a computer simulation, you know, I highly doubt there's going to be any sort of continuity of existence there. You know, you're going to upload yourself, and then you're going to live out the rest of your natural life and die. And you'll have a copy of yourself.
Right.
That is going to believe that it existed, you know, it had the same life that your physical body did. But it's not going to be you. You know, at least from the way we understand awareness.
Not from the way we understand awareness, but the idea is that information, and we're coming back to information theory here, is that information can contain everything as long as you have enough information, including your biases, your fears, your pleasures, whatever the hell it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, it brings up the whole analogy here is the Theseus's axe. Or is it Theseus's ship? I think it's the grandfather's axe paradox or something, where it's like, you know, you have an axe that belonged to your grandfather. He used it for, you know, 60 years to chop down trees. Now, if you give that axe to a master craftsman and he rebuilds it, he makes like a duplicate of that axe down to the wood grain. Is the duplicate also your grandfather's axe? Even though it's exactly the same.
Right.
You know, so if we make a copy of a human brain down to the memories and even the consciousness that's in it, is it really you, or is it just a copy of you believes it's you?
Yeah. The thing is, if you get that fine tuned about it, then does it make a difference?
Yeah, exactly. No, it really doesn't from an objective standpoint. They're both you.
Right.
You're you, and the copy is you.
Right.
Now there's two of you. But from a subjective point of view, it is an other. You know, you're still you. You're still going to live out the rest of your life. You're still going to die, and whatever happens after death is going to happen to you. I know. I think people imagine that, you know, they're going to upload their brain, and then they're going to live in cyberspace. Yeah. But you know, okay, so the cyberspace copy of you is going to have that experience. It's going to, you know, it's going to remember everything up until, you know, it was uploaded. And from its point of view, it's going to have the subjective experience of being uploaded and living out and everything. But
right, unless it's unless it's like dumped into some sort of a very extremely sophisticated robot.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'd heard sort of the...
That thinks its consciousness is located in its head.
Yeah. And sort of had this sort of... there's this idea that you could maybe slowly replace a person or a test subject's brain with, you know, cybernetic replacements.
Oh, until it turns into something that it isn't? Wasn't?
Well, each time, you know, ask, are you you? Like, you know, try to preserve that continuity of existence.
Oh, I see. With the same thing, but it's
yep.
uploaded.
Yeah, until the entire brain is then artificial.
And at that point, you know, is it going to say, are you you? And it'll say, who knows what it's going to say. No, I'm a copy, or what are you talking about? Of course I'm me.
Yeah, it won't know, really. Yeah. And see, it's another philosophical thing, because there's no way for us to know either.
No.
You know, did we?
Because you're not inside that program.
Exactly. Did we just kill a human being and make a copy of them, and this is the copy?
And is there murder going on, or did we help them stay alive, you know?
Like, yeah, you know, should we charge Scotty with a multiple homicide for all the times he beamed people down to the planet?
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, something about, I was thinking about this earlier, to bring it back to the UFO phenomena.
Yes, please. I was going to drag us back kicking and screaming, but yeah, you know how this show goes. We talk about whatever.
Yeah. So something I was thinking about earlier is the sort of phenomena of missing time, in which a person perceives that some period of time has passed, and that amount of time does not sync up with time in the real world. You see it time and again with fairy lore.
Yeah.
You see it in modern UFO abduction cases.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, there's not much scientific research into the abduction phenomena.
No,
and
not really.
I think that's because at least scientists don't really see any practical application for it, you know. But I think that in this instance, there is a very obvious practical application to this, to understanding how this mechanism of missing time and perception of time works. Have you ever had like a dream in which more time passed than what happened on the outside? Not necessarily like a missing time, but like, you know, you have a dream and it seems like you've been dreaming for 3 hours.
Exactly. Yeah, this is starting to sound like a Phil Dick story, but yes.
So that's really fascinating to me, because it implies that our perception of time is entirely or
subjective.
You know, completely subjective.
Right.
And
we know it is, because, you know, if you're busy, time passes faster, seemingly.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, so, wow. It's I've been working so hard and suddenly it's dark. What the hell happened just now?
if we could harness this, if we understood how this mechanism worked and we could actually induce these experiences, you could have, you know, I mean, who knows what the fidelity is? Who knows what the ratio, like the outer limits of this ratio could possibly be?
Yeah, till you either went crazy or it didn't work, or you noticed.
Yeah, imagine being able to go into this trance state for an hour in base reality and spend 5 years in a dream, mm-hmm. you know, researching a topic, you know, doing work. Like, imagine if a scientist could research a topic in a dream world in which they have entire, like, you know, control over everything. Even you could even possibly, like, you know, induce frameworks in which, okay, well, this dream state has the framework of the physical world and it works on the same physical laws that we have in our world.
Right.
But, you know, in this 1 hour, you have 5 years to do research.
Uh-huh.
Like, imagine how quickly that would advance. I mean, talk about a singularity.
Yeah. I mean, well, it has in the past, and it's just by accident.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not the time dilation, but just people pulling information that they need in an altered state.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the whole thing with Watson and Crick.
Yeah.
I forget if it was Watson that discovered the DNA helix while, you know, under the effects of LSD.
Yeah, or said he did.
Yeah,
the German, you know, the famous one, the German scientist that discovered the structure of the, what was it? It was a organic chemical. I can't remember what it was, but yeah, he discovered the nature of the molecule being circular by having a dream about snakes swallowing their tails.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I feel like a lot of times there's a lot of pre-conscious or subconscious processing of information going on all the time. I was just listening to something earlier today that was talking about how every single person who's been alive, you know, for several years is an incredible intuitive physicist, because your brain is constantly doing pre-calculations about, you know, the force you need to grip something or how to keep you stable when walking. And these are like complicated physical problems that you're able to do intuitively without thinking about them at all. It's something I mentioned out of body work before, and it's something that I think led Robert Monroe to discover hemisync. Was he had this obsession with discovering ways to basically learn in an altered state of consciousness, specifically while like being asleep.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know how successful the whole hemisync thing is, but I feel like he was sort of onto the right idea.
Right. Pointing towards what you were just positing a minute ago about shrink wrapping time, or not shrink wrapping, but shrinking time.
Yeah. Sort of shrinking, creating this dilated time.
Yeah. From our point of view.
Yeah. From our point of view.
Yeah.
And how much that could advance just human science. I mean, it would be an incredible amount.
Where'd you find this idea?
It's something I've actually had for, because I had a dream when I was in high school that, I mean,
well,
maybe
I was asking because I was like, so who's working on this besides you?
I wish there were more people working on it. I had sort of a dream when I was in high school that subjectively, I mean, maybe I'm exaggerating here, but it felt like the dream took days to play out.
Yeah.
Subjectively. Like, I remember going to sleep in the dream and waking up and, like, dreams within dreams. And, you know, when I woke up, you know, it's just like a normal night, evening had passed. But I was really weirded out because it felt like so much time had passed in that dream. Yeah. And I've never had a repeat of that experience. But, you know, and then the movie Inception plays with this idea.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because it's actually the only other thing I've ever seen sort of playing around with this idea was that movie. Because, you know, in the movie, there's sort of different layers of dreams. And at the lowest layer, time passes extremely slowly. So, you know, in base reality, only a few, you know, hours or days will pass. But in the, you know, this lowest layer of the dream consciousness, you know, 500 years will have passed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sort of driving whoever was in that dream layer insane from the, you know, stress of having to basically live this dream out for that long.
Right.
And, you know, again, it's something I feel like there's practical scientific applications to better understanding the altered state of consciousness that sort of pervade the UFO contact experience.
Well, yeah. And then you're also getting into, you know, what is the perception of time and can this be done without being in an altered state?
You know, there was a really interesting radio program I heard once. I think it was on NPR, and it was about a home children with various mental disorders. And it was sort of glossed over, but one of the children there had a mental disorder in which she perceived time much differently than the other children. She had sort of superhuman reflexes, because for her, at least, like, and all of her movements were like jerky. Like, she had a really hard time doing anything because she moved too fast. And you could, you know, throw something at her and she would be able to catch it with almost, you know, like a ridiculous reflex instinct.
Yeah.
And it was something about how she perceived time in a different way. For her, everything seemed like it was in slow motion.
Mm-hmm.
And geez, that's fascinating.
Yeah. Like, how can we find out where that wiring went wrong and replicate it?
Yeah, what is different in her that's causing this? Because that's incredible. Like, I mean, you know, and people report, you know, in extreme situations of extreme terror, or, you know, when adrenaline rushes hit you, it seems like time slows down.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember hearing a talk, like a TED talk or something, where a guy was sort of bashing that whole concept and being like, well, that's just your perception. And I'm like, well, it's still a subjective experience.
Yes.
You know, it doesn't matter if it's not objectively real, because that person is perceiving things at a different speed,
yes,
than everything around them.
Yes,
to them, it's real.
Yeah, yeah. And to them, it's real. And when you get outside the situation, you find out that it is like a sports. You know, somebody playing, you know, sees a baseball coming at them at, you know, 90 miles an hour, but they're able to perceive it and see the, you know, and hit the thing. And where most of us are just, we just hear, see a blur come by.
Yeah, so many
and it's not like, yeah, it's not a nothing but. It's like, well, if we're able to perceive at that on that scale,
mm-hmm.
why can't more of us perceive on that scale? You know, and
yes.
why does it have to be learned? And is it learned? Is it an innate talent or what? Can everybody do it? Or is it like, you know, a lot of things where, you know, some people are good at sports and some aren't, and there's some people that would mm-hmm. never be able to do that. But,
I think everything can be learned. I mean, I think it's something that, barring you having some sort of, you know, actual neurological disorder or physical handicap, I think anything on a base level can be learned. Like that, it just basically takes practice.
You mean your grandmother could hit a 90-mile-an-hour fastball out of the park if she had the training and the arm strength?
If she'd been playing baseball for 30 years, sure.
Well, some people have only been playing it for 5 or 10, and they can do it.
Yeah. It's just, I think it's just a matter of training. I mean, and so many
really?
Athletes, yeah, I think so many athletes, you hear about them, you know, getting like in the zone or being in this zone in which they almost perceive themselves outside of themselves.
Right.
And,
exactly. But some of them, but a lot of them don't.
Yeah.
And they never get to that point, and they've had the same amount of training.
But I don't think there's anything inherently different about them. I think it's something that, okay. anyone can be trained to do. I mean, it's just like anybody can be trained to do like out of body work. I think anybody can be trained to go into this like trance state. I mean, I think that's like sort of a tenet of Western magic, even, is this soul like Gnostic state that, you know, different things have different names for it, but I believe it's all sort of the same mental state that these people are being in, either through physical exertion or meditation. Some people just don't have the patience to learn it, and some people do. But I think that everybody has the potential to do it.
I think everybody has a potential to do a lot of things, but I just mm-hmm. think I don't know why it is. Maybe it's a very basic philosophical or whatever thing with me. I think that some people just cannot do certain things. But I think that most people can do a lot more than they think they can.
Yeah, I think we can agree on that. I think a lot of people talk themselves out of a lot of their potential.
Like if I took some kid from, you know, an Eskimo and tried to make him into Michael Jordan, I don't think I could do it.
Well, more
you
of what I'm
get
speaking
close,
of is like a,
but,
a sort
know.
Of mental thing.
Okay, like, yeah, well, mental exercises, yeah. And the other thing is, like, a lot of people, I don't think you can train people to be good psychics. Some people are good at it, mm-hmm. and some people aren't. Some people just have a little bit more of the wiring in their genetic makeup to be able to do it, and other people do not. I don't know if you could train everybody to be a, you know, Joe McMonagall or, well, whatever you think of Uri Geller, but you know what I'm saying.
Well, I think that maybe everybody could learn, like, abilities that are similar to each other. They just need to find what works for them. Like, I feel like not everybody's going to be good at okay, so my whole view on psychic things, especially like telepathy and clairvoyance, like I know we talked sort of about the Amazon Beaming book in which this sort of
yes, I would like you to mention this a little bit more, but please go ahead.
Okay.
What you were saying, because the idea behind that book is fascinating. So
yeah, so I think that different people could be taught different sort of psychic phenomena that better fit what they're interested in or how their brain. Like, I do think people have different sort of personalities and people have different things that they're good at. But I at least believe in terms of like mental abilities, I believe that everybody has the potential. Now, physical stuff's different. Okay, not everybody is going to be a fantastic athlete just because genetics do play a part in physical strength and endurance and that sort of thing.
So it doesn't play a part in mental capacity?
I don't think so. I mean, I just don't believe that.
I don't like to believe it, but that's what I tend to think.
Hmm.
Because and I don't know. I mean, you know, if it's just a matter of attitude, then, you know, because a lot of people try to figure stuff out and they really try hard to, you know,
mm-hmm.
Are they not being taught or trying in the proper way? I don't know. I just think, you know, that at some point there's that you can't teach. There's things that I don't think I'll ever understand. I'm trying very, very diligently to understand them. And eventually I come to some kind of understanding, but not the understanding that like a Nobel Prize, you know, winning physicist would have of the thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I have the capacity to understand it in the way they do. Maybe if you gave me 10 years, maybe.
I think, especially with learning, I think a lot of it has to do with context and passion. I think some people are really good at learning certain things because they are really interested in them. Because there's a lot of things that I wish I knew about and that I've like tried to study, but I can't retain because I just don't care enough about it.
Yeah.
You know, I just don't really care. And so it's especially like work related stuff. Sometimes, you know, I work in information technology and sometimes there are things that it's like, I should really remember how to do this. But I just, my way of getting around it is just to keep good notes.
Yeah, true. But yeah, I still, for some reason, I don't want it to sound elitist or anything. It just seems like no matter how hard some people try, it's just, they're not going to understand something, even if they really want to.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've seen it over and over and over and over again, and I've seen it in myself. I mean, do I have to try harder? I guess I have to try harder. People have the capacity to do a lot more than they think they can. It's just that I think there's a ceiling.
Hmm.
I think there's a ceiling for some people and less of a ceiling for others and maybe no ceiling for a few people. I hate to think that way because it sounds kind of, you know, elitist and horrible, but
is it because of my experience?
I mean, I base it on my experience. So
I think I've got a very low ceiling. Sometimes it's very hard for me to learn new things, but
yeah, well, me too. I mean, I learned how to paraglide and it took me a lot longer than I think it should have taken me. And then, you know, there's another learning curve after that. And you know, what's the thing where you have to do something 10,000 times before you get conversant with it or something like that. I don't remember what that formula was, but
yeah. It's just repetition. I mean, you know, I tried to learn how to play guitar for years, but I never really learned because like, I just didn't practice enough. There's like a very simple reason why I couldn't play guitar.
Yeah.
Because I just didn't do it enough.
Yeah. But if you did practice enough, would you become a virtuoso?
I doubt it. I do believe people have natural talents. I'll agree with you on that. I think some people are naturally talented at other things.
Because there's a lot of people that are very technically talented, but you don't start crying when you hear them play music.
But then again, too, you know, in a lot of ways, a lot of times you only see these people when they're at their best. You really don't know how long it took them to get there. And barring like little kids who are, you know, like can play Mozart at like age 3.
Yeah.
I don't know what to think about those kids.
It's part of your idea that maybe there's, you know, if they wanted to somehow, or they thought they had to really badly, or there's some other thing going on that we don't even know about that just basically opened that channel to them so that their neurology could take care of such complicated movements. But the thing is, nobody, you know, no kids go up and play something. No 5-year-old kid goes up and plays Mozart and the entire audience is enthralled. They're just enthralled because they're so small.
Yeah, they're liking it for the
novelty
reasons. Yeah, the novelty of it.
Yeah. So
I think you wanted me to talk about the Amazon beaming.
Yes, please.
So it was a book that I heard about on Mysterious Universe, and it was I bought the book and read it afterwards, and it's a book about Lauren McIntyre, who is a National Geographic photographer who discovered the source of the Amazon, and it documents his time with a uncontacted tribe called the Mayaruna in South America, I think in Brazil, if I remember correctly. And he sort of gets stranded with them, and nobody in the tribe speaks any English, Portuguese, Spanish, anything. He shares absolutely no language with them. So he gets stranded with them and has to sort of travel with them. And the tribe is on this almost like a suicide march led by their sort of head shaman. He's like driving them away from civilization and to this sort of metaphysical ideal of the source of everything. And Lauren starts to have these telepathic conversations with the head shaman. At first, he doesn't really understand what's going on. And throughout the book, he sort of thinks that he's going insane, or that maybe it's just like a manifestation of how lonely he was, that he was just imagining things. But then there are times when he, like, it just seems like he can't possibly be imagining it. And it isn't a telepathy in a way that he's actually hearing, you know, words in English in his brain. It's right. More of an empathic communication where he sort of receives the emotions that the words would have evoked in him.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, the idea that this sort of empathic communication, and he meets someone later, another tribesman who ends up actually being able to speak Portuguese. So he's able to communicate with him. And that tribesman explains to him that it's like an old way of communicating that, you know, some of the old timers still know how to do, but not a lot of the younger people do. And only a select few are taught how to do it anymore. And it sort of tied into an earlier idea I had in my first blog post on Liminal Room about wondering if examining like Bigfoot legends and wondering if this sort of empathic language isn't a way that early humans communicated with each other before the like development or common use of language.
Mm-hmm.
Because humans had to be able to communicate with each other, even if they didn't have language.
Right.
You know, they had to be able to tell each other about threats. You know, I'm sure sort of vocalizations would have worked for some things, but
right.
Not for other things. And, you know, this sort of empathic language seems to still exist in, you know, in children and the sort of bond between mother and child, the sort of bond you have with people you're extremely close to, like, you know, your wife or your lover, or people you live with. You know, sometimes you know what each other is thinking without actually saying anything to each other. And I sort of believe that this sort of is a manifestation of that sort of empathic language. And it's not something that people use that often because it's kind of pointless once you use language. I mean, that's the whole another thing I've always found sort of silly about the UFO contact phenomena. And one reason I think it's not what it seems is that why would the Greys use telepathy? Why wouldn't they just speak? You know, telepathy is sort of a silly concept if you're standing right in front of someone. It'd be extremely useful if you're communicating at a distance, but I mean, why would you use telepathy if you're in the same room as someone? Why don't we just speak to them? I mean, it's like, it's
what
not...
What was happening to the photographer? Was he in the same room with the shaman, or was he just getting these messages?
No, he would be sitting next to him. They would be with each other.
Oh, okay. So,
yes.
Well, to me, it sounds like that's kind of a, if this is what you're, if it's not what you're saying, tell me, but it sounds like a confirmation of some sort of telepathy. Oh, you hadn't finished your explanation yet.
Oh, well, I was just, you know, I believe it's something that people still have. It's just that it's not super useful. And so we stop using it once we figure out how to talk to each other.
Yeah, it's like an appendix.
Yeah, it's
psychic
like
appendix.
It's sort of an outdated mode of communication. You know, it's interesting and it's nonverbal. And who knows, maybe it's largely made up of like body language and other things like that. You know, there may not be anything supernatural necessarily about it, but it's something that, you know, was basically forgotten about once language popped up because language was simply more useful. Mm-hmm. It's much easier just to tell someone what you need to tell them.
Right.
Instead of having them empathically deduce what you want them to do. And I can't imagine trying to have like, you know, trying to express complicated or abstract ideas in a, you know, an empathic.
No, it just sounds like more like a emotion laden, basic, feeling. Like there is danger, mm-hmm. or I love you, or mm-hmm. you know, whatever it is, or whatever, you know, when people are attracted sexually or whatever, all mm-hmm. these things are going on, and those are nonverbal, but those are the vestiges of it.
And you had mentioned the other night too that you had thought that may have some sort of key to what's going on during the contact phenomena, that there's some sort of this nonverbal communication taking place using symbols and archetypes and tropes that are familiar to the contactee.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what's, but, you know, I don't know how much that communication is coming from outside of them. You know, it's back to my, you know, how much do we contribute to the dance argument or idea. But that, yeah, if there is something coming to somebody and it's telepathic and there is something that they actually saw or some, you know, non-human person or something that appeared human, probably wasn't, whatever you want to call it, that, you know, in light of what you just said and in light of what goes on in the Amazon Beaming book, is that something was communicated non-verbally and they just, you know, they extrapolated everything from that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, you know, Lauren mentions that, you know, again, it's not like he heard the words in English in his head. He more felt the emotions that the words would have generated in him. He still sort of constructed the words himself.
Yeah.
Based on this, you know.
Yeah, and he's already at a remove from whatever the message was because he's encoding it in language already.
Exactly, yeah. And it's interesting, too, because once he ends up meeting, the tribe links up with a larger contingent of the tribe, and he meets the native that can speak Portuguese. He sort of loses the whole time he's with the original group, he can hear this background hum going on whenever he's with the tribe.
Yeah.
And he sort of imagines that they're all communicating with each other on some level, almost like a hive.
Yeah.
Maybe they're not communicating as directly as the head shaman can, because, you know, he has developed and practiced this ability as some sort of religious, you know, ritual.
Right.
But that they're still all communicating with each other on this nonverbal level. And once he starts speaking language again, once he starts using language again with this other native, he sort of loses that background hum. He can't hear it anymore.
Hmm.
Because I guess that the
when he was quiet, that came up because that opened that channel, or if you want, whatever you want to call it. And when he started talking, it kind of shut it down because it wasn't needed at that point.
Yeah, exactly. It's no longer needed, so you know, he stops using it because ultimately it's less useful than just language.
Yeah. Joshua says, McKenna said telepathy's primary importance would be to impart clarity of meaning, very useful even at a distance.
Exactly, yeah. And I think McKenna was 100% on to something there. I mean, I don't know if he ever read this book or heard about this tribe, but I think that would confirm some of his ideas about that. And like I said, maybe we're still using it when we talk with each other. We just don't realize it. But maybe you know how people who are sometimes on the autism spectrum, like people with Asperger's, they're unable to retrieve context from conversations, and sometimes it makes them socially awkward because they're unable to communicate in exactly the same way as other people can.
Yeah, maybe their sublingual antenna doesn't work right.
Yeah, maybe that portion isn't working like it should. And again, it could be a combination of a lot of things. It could be, you know, we know for a fact that part of it's body language as well.
Right, right.
You know, when people are talking to one another, there are a million just physical, you know, clues to context that we process subconsciously.
Yeah.
But maybe there's this, you know, third layer that, you know, it's a combination of verbal, you know, physical context clues, and maybe there's this, you know, sort of underlying low-level empathic channel that runs between all of us.
I wonder how you could test for that.
That's the question, right? I mean, it sort of makes me think of ideas about the collective consciousness.
Yeah.
You know, like, do we all sort of share some sort of net? I mean, what was the name of that project? The Global Human Consciousness Project or whatever it was that had the machines, the pseudo-random number generators generating ones and zeros and seeing how they linked up.
Yeah, Raiden was involved in it. I think it's still going.
Yeah, so, you know, I think that's maybe a way to sort of test for that channel a little bit. I mean,
I don't know
what you think of that data, but I think it's interesting.
I think it's compelling. You think it's interesting. I believe it's compelling. But then again, that's my, you know, I know it's my belief system coming in saying I'm really interested in stuff that doesn't really fit or that other people are hostile to because it doesn't seem to make logical sense. That's my bias.
See, that's the thing, though. I think it would if you could prove the existence of this like empathic channel, Like, I feel like that would explain a lot of things. Like, I feel like it doesn't necessarily not make sense. If that exists, it certainly answers some questions. You know, if the Global Consciousness Project thing, you know, sort of the idea behind it is that he sees these spikes when there are, you know, large traumatic disasters and
right.
and things like that. And that would make sense if it's sort of an empathic link between people.
Yeah, but it has to be something, you know, what they've found out is it has to be something that affects people deeply emotionally.
Exactly.
And there seems to be a causal relationship between things that affect people deeply on an emotional level, like 9/11 or Princess Di dying or whatever, you know, when they announce the winner of, you know, very small, the winner of the Academy Award, just things like that, where everybody's paying, a lot of people are paying attention, millions at basically the same time. And the other fascinating thing is they start becoming non-random before the thing happens.
Oh, that's something. I was about to make an Alderaan joke, but this is actually better. I was mentioning Blindside by Peter Watts earlier. There is a whole part in that book. There's a really great appendix that goes into some of the scientific basis of some of the ideas that are in the novel. And one of the really interesting studies he cites is a scientist who determined that there seemed to be no cause and effect between human actions, which seemed to indicate there was no such thing as free will. Because he would basically drop a ball for a person to catch, or like a simple reflex activity.
Right.
And he was measuring, you know, the electrical impulses, you know, in people's bodies and like their brain activity. And he was able to determine that these people's reflexes, the electrical impulses for them to move whatever body part they were using were already traveling before they consciously made the decision to do it.
You mean the activity in the brain was already going before they said, I'm going to do this thing?
Or rather, the electrical impulses traveling to the muscles to perform whatever physical action they were doing was already on its way before, like, they were able to see in the brain the decision to do that thing.
Yeah, I see.
It seemed to be that the effect was preceding the cause.
Right. Which is something we've talked about on the show about what is the nature of time? Is it an illusion? Is causality what we think it is? And I really don't think it is. There's lots of evidence that causality is not determined by the future.
Definitely. Barring that study, you know, being incorrect or some mismeasurement of the sensors or something, it brings up extremely troubling questions about causality. You know, are we really perceiving? You know, we perceive time as a flow
from future to past or whatever.
Exactly, but is it really, or is that just how we have to interact with it because of the way our brains are wired?
Yeah, and I don't look at it as a problem. I look at it as an exciting, it's like, really? Yeah, let's look at this and see if there's any evidence for such a thing. And, you know, without being deluded about things, I mean, that's my general thing. It's like something that looks very interesting. Let's look at as many parts of it as we can that seem to be reasonable, not people that are totally into it and say, you know, obviously, just because science says it isn't possible, that means it must be possible, which is a very stupid thing to say. Or, on the other hand, a dyed-in-the-wool scientist has said, well, this can't be possible because of the way we understand the physical universe right now. It's like, well, that's, you just said it right now. So, you know, it's something to be compelling without having to buy into it.
You know, actually, I'm sort of on the opposite end of the spectrum in that I think that has, like, terrifying implications.
Because of free will?
Not necessarily because of free will, but that it reminds me of something that the character of Rust Cole says in True Detective, that time is a flat circle, and that the reason we have things like precognition and deja vu is because we've already done those things.
Yeah.
Everything is happening over and over again, and if that's true, then there's no such thing as reincarnation or an afterlife. You just live the same life over and over and over again for all eternity.
Yeah.
You know, the reason you know something's going to happen, that you have a precognitive episode, is because, well, you've already done it.
Or You don't have to listen to crazy. What's the actor's name?
Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah, McConaughey. You know, it's perspective. You know, the thing I think is that it's everything that is nothing has happened before or in the future. It's just all there. Mm-hmm. You can look at it. You can become. What's the word? You can become nihilistic about it and think that you're just doing the same thing over and over again, and it's horrible. Or you can think, even though everything is determined, we have to get through it and figure it out, and you know, and experience it because we're three dimensional beings living a certain amount of years on this planet and all that. But
yeah, maybe time is a sort of flat plane, and that you're looking, you can look behind you and you can look in front of you.
Right, or is what we think is behind and in front.
Yeah, or in some rare cases, or maybe if you know how, you can, move up into the air a little bit and see what it looks like from 30,000 feet. And
right,
you can
exactly.
See that. Well, you're not on a flat plane. That time itself, everything is there, and you can see everything at once.
Right. That's another model for it too. It's just that I. I realize that I'm doing this here, Ren, but it's what I tend to, my models tend to move towards things that make me feel better. I mean, I hate to say that.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. We got to have something.
Yeah. I mean, if the model sounds like a hopeless thing where I have no choice and everything sucks and it's mm-hmm. terrible, I'll move away from that model. If it's a model for the exact same thing, where it makes me feel good and that I can move forward and is makes me act nicely towards everybody else and all that, mm-hmm. I will cling to that model even because I realize it's just a goddamn model.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Because I have no idea whether time is circular or that it is, doesn't exist or whatever. But the model for mm-hmm. me is, I have access to some people, and mm-hmm. if I'm lucky, me, have access to not having to be stuck into it.
Yeah, and I think that's why we study this stuff. We want to be able to look at these things from 30,000 feet. I mean, isn't that what Don Juan was sort of trying to teach Carlos Castaneda?
Yeah.
That the goal is to be able to sort of transcend, and by studying these sort of things you can look at things from the outside instead of being stuck inside of them.
Yeah. And you have some sense of, wholeness that doesn't destabilize you.
Mm-hmm.
As long as I can remain, it comes from Wilson, Robert Anton Wilson and his winter script thing. As long mm-hmm. as I can remain interested and positive, I think it's mm-hmm. a better way to go through life than being uninterested or hopeless or whatever.
Definitely, yeah. Well, I mean, I think you can definitely stay positive by just staying curious.
Yeah, exactly.
And not painting yourself into a corner in terms of ideology or beliefs.
Right.
Always leaving yourself some room to wiggle.
Yeah, and it's if something's a trap, it's no good for you.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, we got very deep here in the last few minutes.
Yeah, we got very philosophical. It's good.
No, that's fine. You know what's weird is we held the amount of listeners throughout the entire show, so everybody liked the show.
That's great. I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah. I was gonna, the thing. We still have a few minutes. I mean, we don't have to stop at 8 o'clock, but I kind of have to because I got to start working for Coast to Coast.
Yeah.
The only thing you have that's public right now is Liminal Room, right?
That's right. Yeah, and like I said, it's a new blog. I'm just now sort of dipping my toes in the water and trying to write things, write down my ideas, and put some things on paper. I've got a couple more blog posts in the pipeline, like I mentioned to you the other night. I'm working on one sort of talking about Albert Bender's experiences with the Men in Black and sort of my experiences with Dwellers on the Threshold, sort of the shadow people that people see when in these altered states of consciousness and what I think they are. And I also have some ideas I was thinking about today that I pulled from John Mack's book, where I have sort of a personal cosmology that is in a way and sort of my build onto what Mac Tonies was working on mm-hmm. in terms of his crypto-terrestrials thing. Again, in the same spirit as Mac, it's sort of just a thought experiment. It's not necessarily what I believe,
No, yeah. Well, none of us believe anything. Anybody that comes to me with a belief, I'm going to shut down. Not shut down, but I poke at them till I find out if it's a belief. Because if it's a belief, mm-hmm. I can't talk to them anymore, and we can't exchange ideas, and we can't kick ideas around and change them.
Yeah, I've got sort of some fun ideas about you know, this sort of fiction I have in my head about what the UFO phenomenon could be. Mm-hmm. Maybe just one sort of thought experiment about it. And I'm also trying to sort of work on a book. It's something that I was going to ask for help around, sort of, because I still sort of need some help learning how to research this kind of stuff. And I have a book specifically where I wanted to talk more about the abduction phenomenon, specifically the sort of elements in which people interact with entities. I think it's a fascinating topic. I've always been fascinated by both the contactees and the abduction narrative as it took place in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and how different it was to the contactee experience of the 50s and 60s. I'm still meaning to read Aaron Gulias' work on it.
Yes. Yes, that's an important part of the research on that. I'm just now reading... My wife is attending a university where she's getting a degree in mythological studies.
Oh, so, amazing.
Yeah. So it's fun. Whenever she has a paper, she goes, I'm stuck. This is what I'm doing right now. I'm trying to figure out if this is a Jungian shadow or if it's a psychological problem. And, so I'm learning along with her. But she went to the bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
This weekend while she was at school, and she bought me a copy of Varieties of Anomalous Experience.
Oh man, that's great.
And the first thing I went to is the Alien Abduction Experiences chapter 8.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'm like I said, I'm reading through Mac's book right now, and it's really good stuff. I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah, I mean, if anybody is kind of mining the same area that Mac was, I from reading the bits of your blog that I did and talking to you, it sounds like you're sort of going. I mean, for the plain fact that we talked about AI and mm-hmm. singularity and all that, Mac was applying those ideas to the UFO experience or whatever subject matter,
mm-hmm.
and nobody's really done that since then. And you know, I read your stuff and talk to you, and it's like, well, you know what? I think Ren's kind of going in that same direction, and I think it would be exciting to see what he has to say, which is one of the main reasons I had you on.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you having me on. I mean, I'm it's kind of what I wanted to start writing for, so I could start, you know, engaging in conversations with people about this topic. And, you know, I'm very glad, and, you know, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Sure. And we will never finish this conversation. So, of course, you'll be back at some point. I am certain. I would like you to be back at some point because it's it's I could talk to you for hours and we probably will. And I'd like some of it to be public. So,
yeah, definitely. Anytime you want to have me back on, I'd love to do it.
OK, great. All right. As you know, mm-hmm. since you're the guest, is there a piece of music you want me to play? And I could just pull it off YouTube for the outro here.
Could you play Subterraneans by David Bowie from Low?
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, I was just listening to Bowie today while I was doing some work on the computer.
Ah, synchronicity.
Yeah, yeah. V2 Schneider isn't on Low, is it?
I can't remember. I just listened to Low for the first time the other day. I'd never really listened to it before. Station to Station had always been my favorite Bowie album, but I started listening to Low, and I think that Low is quickly replacing it as my favorite. I know it's my
really, it's his total gothed out, like depressive album.
It is. Maybe that's the mindset I'm in right now, but it's good stuff. You know, I never really paid much attention to it, and it's so different from some of his other work.
It totally is. I mean, he went through a lot of periods, and they're all interesting, and this is just mm-hmm. one of them.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's, you know, my favorite sort of David Bowie album that isn't a David Bowie album is Iggy Pop's The Idiot.
Yeah, exactly. It might as well be a David Bowie album.
Yeah, basically, he's on like half the tracks, so he might as well be a Bowie album.
Yeah, and he toured with him for it, too. He played keyboards and did some backups vocals, I believe.
Yep. Yeah, he's in nightclubbing, definitely. He's doing like the background vocals.
Yeah, I mean, you can definitely hear his voice in there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, Ren Collier, thank you so much for being on. Totally interesting. I loved it that I had to keep up with you, and those are the best kind of interviews.
Awesome. Thank you, Greg. I really appreciate being on the show. And, sure. You know, anytime you want to invite me back, I'll be happy to talk.
Okay. And we'll talk soon and communicate. Cool. And here's Subterraneans by Bowie, and I will talk to you soon.
All right. Talk to you later.
All right. Thanks.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye. Whoa.